Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is journalist and former ABC News correspondent Bob Brown, who will be inducted into the University of Tulsa Communication Hall of Fame tomorrow evening. Bob Brown is a Tulsa native who began his career at KRMG, eventually moving to KAKC, and his first television job at KOTV. In 1977, he joined the ABC News Network as one of Rune Arledge's first non-star hires, as he says, as a correspondent. He spent over a decade reporting on the ABC Evening News. In 1980, he moved to the news magazine 2020, where he would remain for the next 30 years. While at 2020, he received 6 Emmy Awards, the Investigative Reporters Award, and the DuPont Columbia Award. He's also a member of the ensemble of reporters that won a Peabody Award for their 24-hour ABC News special on the dawn of the new millennium. Many of his stories have inspired Hollywood screenplays. Films have been based on his stories, include Fly Away Home, Door to Door, and The Pursuit of Happiness. All told, 12 of his news stories eventually became feature films. Again, Bob Brown will be inducted in the University of Tulsa Communication Hall of Fame tomorrow night, and he joins us today to talk about his career here on Studio Tulsa. Bob Brown, congratulations on being inducted into the Communication Hall of Fame, and welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Take us back, because I would think you're probably one of the last generations that actually maybe have started in the newsroom before you got the formal education in journalism.
That's true. Because
you were working for a number of years before you got your degree here at TU.
I started in high school. I was in it was called the Tulsa Little Theater then, production of
Theater Tulsa now.
Yeah, Kane Mutiny Court Martial. And I played a young sailor who was grilled his near collapse on the witness stand, and Doug Humphreys, who was a salesman at KRMG Radio, was also in the cast, and they needed somebody to cover the weekends for them. He suggested that I come and read an audition at the station, which I did. I had already been reading copy out loud to myself. Ed Dumit, who taught here at the University of Tulsa, had a pronunciation book that I went through religiously. So when I showed up at KRMG and did the audition, I was able to do it cold without booting any words, largely because of Ed's book and my obsession with reading news copy aloud before that.
So you wanted to be a broadcaster?
Yes. Uh-huh. And they hired me to do the weekends, and then about 6 or 7 months after that, I would pretty much come in all the time. And if they needed somebody to cover an extra shift or somebody's vacation or to do news stories, I would always volunteer.
You're sort of that last generation of people who maybe started in the newsroom, apprenticed, and sort of moved their way up without the journalism degree, although you did get a journalism degree here.
I did, and it was an important step for me. I didn't graduate till I was 24 because I had gone on to KAKC and then KOTV in Tulsa and was able to pay my way through the University of Tulsa doing that. And so I went through rather slowly, got my degree, and then got drafted for 2 years. But the great thing about the University of Tulsa was how it opened my mind and my eyes to all of the things that were beyond what I was doing in my daily work.
That daily work is so geared around the local news event of the day.
Right. And you can know what a Signal 82 is, which is an auto accident with injuries, and you can kind of get the gist of City Hall. But beyond that, there comes a time in your career when you need to know that other information exists somewhere, and even if you don't remember it, you know where to look for it. And at ABC, that became crucial to me, and it goes back to the education I got here because it was a terrific liberal arts education. Art, biology, religion courses, all of those things that when you're young, you don't really understand why you're studying because you want to do something else and how is that related. But later in life, you understand how important they are.
How important was that liberal arts education to your daily work producing stories for ABC?
In several regards, one of which was towards the end of my career at ABC, I wound up doing the showenders, which is if they had to do a special on some disaster or someone's death or any one of the number of things that they did specials on, they would call on me to put it in perspective at the end of the show. And so I would immediately go to historical research or, well, I can remember when Hurricane Katrina hit, and we did several evenings specials. And I did a show ender on the Dust Bowl migration because so many people had to migrate out of Louisiana and go to other places where we knew they would be welcome for a week or two. But the whatever the what the long term was going to be might have been quite a different picture. And that's
yes, we have to remember the Dust Bowl, there were gates at the entry to California, and if you had no money, they turned you away.
Exactly. Yeah. And once the well, okie was a dirty word when I was growing up. I don't know whether it still is.
You know, I mean, but, I think it's lost its but it you're right. My well, father's good. Generation was, it was like a slur. They considered it a slur.
It still was. And yeah. I can remember that the Grapes of Wrath was not as pertinent as it was to a lot of the history of the state, was not on any of our reading lists, and was resented right. by a lot of people. So I suppose that's changed a bit. But,
and you use that to tell the story of Katrina.
Exactly, to tell a story of how the emigres from Louisiana might ultimately face in terms of once the welcome has worn out, where do you go from there? And some of those incidents did happen in the same way they happened after the Dust Bowl migration.
Mm-hmm. How did you move to the network? How did it come about?
I was working at WFAA in Dallas as a weekend anchor, and also was doing a series called Texas Tales, where I would go around the state and find a place where some legend had existed. And there's always 100 people anywhere there's a legend in Texas who can tell you the story of it and may have known somebody who was involved in it. And the general manager of WFAA, a man named Mike Shapiro, I actually had a conversation with him. I was in my early 30s and told him that I felt I had done as much as I could do there and wanted to try working for a network. And they had just offered me a new contract, which was the reason the subject came up. And Mr. Shapiro, who was one of those gentlemen you encounter on rare occasions but who can change your life, said, "I'll tell you what, I will do what I can to place you at ABC or to let the people at ABC know about you. You negotiate with them or talk with them or audition for them as long as you need to. And if they hire you, you go off with my blessing. And if they don't, we'll sign the contract." Hmm. So it was
wow.
a win-win situation for me. And he did help send one of my tapes to ABC with those feature stories on them. And they hired me. As it turned out, Rune Arledge was taking over the news division. This was in 1977, amid some controversy, because Rune was a great show.
He was from sports.
He was from sports, and nobody really understood what he might do with the newsroom. And Rune had me hired. And up to that point, Rune had hired nobody but existing stars mm-hmm. to try to fill up the ABC correspondent lists with people who were better known. So I was his first, I always say I was his first non-star hire. But we had a wonderful relationship after that. And the assignments I got were, to a large extent, human interest stories that they wanted to do, I think because of the auditions that they'd seen. I mean, there were plenty of hard news assignments as well, but that was, if I had a specialty to speak of, that was the one that I followed.
Was that something you were always interested in doing, the human interest? Because that sounds like what you were doing in Texas at Dallas. Was
yes.
Trying to, I mean, was that what attracts you to that, you think?
I think because these human interest stories generally involve people who aren't well known, but who have some element in their lives that speaks volumes to the rest of us. And they deserve time in a medium which tends to concentrate on people who are politicians or people who commit crimes, the standard list of the types of stories that newsrooms tend to cover. And I wanted to do human interest. This is actually a thought that came to me much later, but when I was trying to ask myself the same question you've asked, I wanted to do human interest and apply the same journalistic principles to those stories that were applied to hard news stories. because when I was starting in the business, human interest stories were considered throwaways and not really stories that you spent a lot of time or effort on, but you did them because they were good show closers.
Soft and cuddly.
Soft and cuddly.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I wound up doing at ABC, if a story I did had a happy ending or a satisfying ending, and not all of them did, I would try to follow up 6 months, a year, 2 years later to find out whether the conclusion of the story or the opinions that may have been generated by the way the story ended, whether that was valid. And that was important to me to know that either it was or it wasn't. And
I think that's pretty novel for a human interest story. You know, if it ends happily ever after happily ever after,
right.
You know, I mean.
You want to know whether, just the same as you want to know whether a story, an investigative piece you did, that resulted in some action or that may have resulted in someone's loss of a job
livelihood,
or status
freedom,
or
livelihood, right,
whatever.
Yeah.
You want to know that you were accurate because people's lives can blow up sometimes depending on what you've done. And I thought the same principle should apply to all types of stories.
Was that a hard to get across to your producers and to the people you were working with as far as taking a very journalistic approach to a human interest story?
Not really.
They got it.
Yeah, and the producers that I worked with at ABC were, to a person, extraordinary people in their own rights, and they, too, had been doing that type of story when we were assigned to work together. I remember I did a story in England. This one was kind of a throwaway story. It was on the troubles that the royal family was facing long before Charles and Di, and I wish I could remember more about it, but I worked with a producer named Joe Pfifferling, and the story went on, and it was humorous, and there was quite a bit of information in it, too, regards the history of the family and why its troubles might have continued through several generations, not just the one that we were aware of. And in the room where 2020 was produced, where sat the director and the assistant director and the executive producer, whose name was Ob Weston. After the story ran, the phone rang, which happened often, and the little red light said that it was from Brune Arledge's office. And Ob Weston, the executive producer, picked up the phone and said, yes. And it was Rune, and he said, who worked with Bob on that story that just ran? And Ob said, Joe Pfifferling. And Rune said, make sure they work together from now on. And hung up, and that was how that started, and that's generally how those pairings were made. Rune was brilliant at knowing how people worked together and how collaborations should work, because Rune was, at his core, an extraordinary collaborator, not just a boss. When he would executive produce the Olympics, he wouldn't just tell people what to do. He would seek opinions. He would watch 100 feeds coming in on 100 monitors and talk to the people who were behind them and know exactly what was going to happen, when it was going to happen, and where the drama was in the Olympic events that he was doing. I may be getting a little ahead of, or maybe behind myself. Rune became best known for producing these extraordinary Olympic events when ABC had the Olympics contract.
Right. Uh-huh.
But basically, that's by way of saying he knew about collaboration and how important it was and how key it was to the types of shows that we were doing.
Well, he innovated sports programming, because before, sports programming was just here's the event. And,
right.
And he, you know, ABC Wired World of Sports,
yes,
was about editing the tape to show the absolute drama of the event.
Exactly.
The human interest of the event, the emotion of the event, and utterly transformed sport. And you worked with him when he was working in a newsroom. Obviously, Rune Arledge has had an incredible impact on how broadcast television transmits news as well.
Yes.
It's somewhat more controversial because people say that sort of dramatic element sort of heightens, you know, the emotion of the storytelling. But
that's
but
true.
What's your experience from working with Rune as far as what were the things that you thought were truly groundbreaking?
Well, the criticism that you mentioned was one that was leveled at him when he did take over the news division, and I never saw an example of his trying to inject emotion into a story that didn't contain it already. But I do know that Rune liked stories that had that emotion built into it, or if he felt people were missing the drama in a story, he would assign someone else to the same type of story again. And I'll give you some examples. I covered, when I was working as an evening news correspondent, Harry Reasoner and then Frank Reynolds and Peter Jennings were doing the show. I covered sports events, and there was, in 1978, there was a playoff between the Red Sox and the Yankees, the final game to determine who went to the World Series, and that was the famous Bucky Dent home run. And I happened to be assigned to that story, and used lots of close-ups in the context of it to try to build the tension that existed in the game, because it was back-and-forth game up to the point where Dent hit the home run. And Roone liked that, because the typical reporting of stories like that was just to essentially go to the home run and without commenting on or showing the drama that existed up to that point. So the drama existed. It was just that when Roone was running the newsroom, he wanted to make sure that if it existed, it was in the story. There was a visit by, and this was in 79, Pope John Paul II visited Harlem. And this was actually the story that finally got me transferred over to 2020. And they assigned, the Pope was on a schedule in New York, and he was to visit St. Patrick's, if I recall correctly, in the morning and then go to a luncheon. And there was a different correspondent who was assigned to each one of those events. And they assigned me to the location in Harlem where the Pope was going to speak as the last event of the day. I showed up in Harlem because as a correspondent, you can get really paranoid about what your competition may do to wipe you out. And so I went to the extreme. I showed up at Harlem at 4 o'clock in the morning. And he wasn't due to speak until 4:30 that evening, just to see what it looked like and to get my bearings. And what Roone would have agreed, I don't think they asked him directly, but what the assignment desk knew they could and should do if I asked for it, they gave me a crew at 4 in the morning, as opposed to saying, why don't you go out and do what you have to do and your crew will show up at 3. But that was the kind of innovative spirit that Roone supported. So I got the crew at 4:30, and it was a mess on that street corner where that the Pope was due to visit in 12 hours or so. So we shot the junkies who were hanging out on the street corner and interviewed them, and then as the day progressed, we did one of those hour-by-hour chronology stories where the city of New York showed up, and they began towing away all the junk cars that were parked along the street. And then, instead of using the pool camera for the Pope's visit, we met a woman at mid-morning who was excited about his coming and decided to stay with her all day long, where the focus was not just on the Pope, but on the people, on the drama of the people who were waiting for him to appear and whose reactions would be crucial to his appearance.
And you also got a sense of that sort of Potemkin Village as well, as where, you know, what the Pope saw was not what that street was like.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we spent the day with her. We followed her kids to school. We went to a Head Start program where these adorable young kids were being taught about the Pope and what he represented, and who remembered that when the Pope generally arrived in a new country, he would kiss the ground on the airport tarmac, and who asked, is he going to kiss the ground in Harlem? It was just, they were delightful kids.
Sounds like a great story.
We went up and shot out her window when the Pope arrived, rather than using the pool camera. We used the pool camera for one of the Pope's sound bites, but we were looking at her reaction. And when the story ran in a special that evening, Roone, they were just starting 2020, I think decided that he wanted to transfer me over, because we had done our journalistic duty, which was to show the Pope's visit and what he said, but we had also shown the drama behind the visit, and that drama would have been there regardless. And this is, again, my probably gone way too long in making the point about Roone. He was criticized by many people because of his tendency toward and his love of that type of story, but he expected that when you did that story, it was real, that you weren't faking or phonying up any scenes to make it more than it was. But he just liked the point of view.
But you also told a larger truth. I mean, the whole idea that, you know, the Pope visits Harlem and it's not the Harlem that the people exist in every day.
Not even close to it.
Right,
although by
the
time he got there, the street was clean and
right.
And it looked like a, a nice, pristine environment. But you're absolutely right. I took the same approach, I remember, that I learned from that after 9/11. When the buildings came down, they sent correspondents out all over town. And we went down to a place several blocks north of where the World Trade Center had been, and found a group of iron workers who were insisting that they should go into the site immediately because they or their fathers had put up the World Trade Center, and they knew the dangers behind what might happen if people who were inexperienced walked around twisted steel beams that might snap on them at any moment. And things were so confused at the time that we had to devote and spend several hours with them. Now, there were other crews who were going around and interviewing all types of people, and they got great sound bites, but the stories didn't advance. We stayed with the steelworkers until after darkness fell again. Someone came and realized who they were and took them in on a truck with hard hats. So we rode in with them because we were using a digital camera by that time, and got some of the first scenes as the steelworkers rode in of what they were riding past and of what they came to call the potato chip, which was that remnant of the World Trade Center that became such a symbol after they came down. And then the story we ran the next day, but it was obviously not the same, but similar to the story we did on the Pope, which was when you choose a specific point of view to tell a story from, very often that story can develop in ways that are much more significant than just pulling together a lot of different opinions and putting them on the air, which is what everyone else is going to be doing anyway.
You have to have patience for that approach.
A lot of patience.
And you have to have sort of confidence that something's going to pan out. I assume sometimes it doesn't pan out.
That's true. And you have to have an assignment desk that's willing to let you take the risk. And risk does become an element in the way you cover stories. And after a certain point in my career here, actually, under Clayton Vaughn at KOTV as well as at ABC, people are willing to let you take a risk if you've shown what the return can be as a result.
My guest today is Bob Brown, a former ABC News correspondent. He was on 2020 for, gosh, almost 30 years.
30 years, yeah.
Wow. Winner of 6 Emmys, every award in the business. He's going to be inducted in the University of Tulsa Communication Hall of Fame tomorrow, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I want to ask you, we have just a little bit of time left. You've had, at least I can think of, 3 stories that have become movies.
Yeah.
Fly Away Home.
Right.
Door to Door.
Door to Door.
The Pursuit of Happiness.
The Will Smith film.
Now, I assume they didn't option you for the story.
No.
Yeah,
they offered, in each case, all total over my career, there were a dozen movies, but those were the 3 best known that became minor classics in their own. After we had a story called Father Goose about a man who became the first human being to lead a flock of geese on a southward migration, and it wasn't just that he wanted to see if he could do it. It was the point behind it was there were lots of endangered migratory bird species that, if it worked with geese, which because it was easy to get wildlife permits to work with geese, then it might work with these endangered birds, and subsequently it has. We did the story, followed it for 6 to 8 months between the time that he trained the geese and he actually flew them to a location south of Canada where he worked. The next day, Sony Pictures called and wanted to do something immediately. They eventually hired Carol Ballard, the director who did The Black Stallion, known for his nature movies, to do Fly Away Home. Generally, in every instance, they've asked me to help or recommend or take some role in it. But if you're working as a journalist, it's not if you were willing to quit and do it, fine. But if you're working as a journalist, the point to me is that you should never think that you're doing a story because you might benefit from it or profit from it at some point after the story has run, because then you are going to not do it the way it ought to be done and not apply all the journalistic principles that ought to be applied to it. So, no, I never accepted any offers that I got as a result of it, but I was happy to refer them to people who would help them. On The Pursuit of Happiness, Chris Gardner was the man who had been homeless and became a multimillionaire stockbroker as a result of the grit that he had.
Yeah, what is your feeling about seeing your news story being converted in a movie? Because it's always going to have creative license telling of the story, and it's not journalistic at all.
No, and Fly Away Home wasn't the story that we did, but they had a lot of shots in the movie that were exact duplicate. It was brilliantly shot, but they wanted to increase the drama in the movie by having his daughter involved, and she actually does the final leg of the flight in the movie, if I'm not mistaken, which of course never happened. But Door to Door, I thought, captured the truth behind this door-to-door salesman with cerebral palsy. His name was Bill Porter, who got that job despite the disability he had, and who diligently hung on to it with the help of the community around him for many, many years. There was a lot of dramatic license taken with his story, but I thought they arrived at the truth of his story expertly. That was done by William H. Macy. Helen Mirren was in the movie. And I thought the same was true of The Pursuit of Happiness. From what I knew of Chris Gardner's story, despite the dramatic license they took with it, that the truth of it was what you were left with when the story ended. And that's the difference between Hollywood and journalism. You always seek to arrive at the truth. Hollywood can arrive at the truth in a slightly different way. But if the essential truth exists when you've seen the product, then that's the best, I think, that you can expect from Hollywood. And in a couple of instances, I thought they reached it.
Yeah. Well, now you've retired from ABC News.
Yes.
Now, I know that, journalists, when they retire, they inevitably find other projects to keep them busy. Have you found any that have sort of captured your heart as far as telling stories? Because once you're in the storytelling business, it's kind of hard to get out of it.
I would like to. Well, I have written fiction.
Uh-huh.
And I have a book with an agent now, and I have no idea what's going to happen when the agent sends it out. I don't even know whether it's publishable, but it's fiction, and it's about storytelling and the power of stories to change a life. In this case, it's the life of a young boy who believes one thing about himself and the people that he's with and the conflicts that he's involved in. And over the course of the book, when he learns this sequence of stories that unfolds, comes to a completely different conclusion. Not necessarily a happy one, but an accurate one that he can live by and claim.
Well, we wish you great luck with this next phase of your career in writing fiction. And congratulations on the Hall of Fame here at the University of Tulsa. They're very proud of your career and your legacy here at TU. So thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. And I'm proud to have been here.
Former ABC News correspondent Bob Brown speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. The Tulsa native and University of Tulsa alum will be inducted into the University of Tulsa Communication Hall of Fame tomorrow evening here on the TU campus. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, they're available online at our newly designed website, publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa and the shows are there. Listen on demand. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.